Welcome to the CEO Only podcast produced by Association Forum. I'm Michelle Mason, President and CEO. Today's guest is Dave Lutz, Managing Director at Velvet Chainsaw Consulting. In 2006, Dave founded and began serving as Managing Director of Velvet Chainsaw Consulting, a business improvement firm that helps conference and trade show organizers grow or transform their major face-to-face conferences. Prior to going down the consulting road, Dave was with Experian for 22 years, where he served as president of both the meeting planning and registration divisions. Dave is a frequent industry speaker and pens thought-provoking articles to help meeting owners and professionals progress. For over 12 years, he has authored a monthly column in PCMA's Convene magazine on performance improvement for annual conferences and trade shows. That's a lot, Dave, but you are so accomplished and we're excited to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Michelle. Great to be with you.
Fantastic. Well, today we're going to talk about healthcare meetings. We're going to focus on learning trends and also trade shows. Dave is such an accomplished leader in our industry, so we're going to bounce around a little, but we know that our audience will learn a lot from his knowledge and expertise. So with that intro, Dave, I'm just going to start the conversation with you. How's that?
Sounds great.
Awesome. Recently, Dave, you wrote an article on patient-centered care conferences. Just for the audience, help us understand what that means. What is a patient-centered care conference?
Well, patient-centered is really, you know, when the Affordable Act was, in play, and most of it still is, under Obamacare. The next evolution was to become, to do reimbursement more based on patient outcomes versus treatments. And there's no question that I think, when you talk to, people that are looking at how to improve and the U.S. healthcare system, being patient, performance based is an area that we do believe is the next horizon. So while we're not quite there yet, we do believe that that's the direction that people are going. So I think what's happening in the future is, well, in the medical space, what we see is it's definitely becoming more of a team sport as well. So it's more team centered care focused on the patient. So the patient's at the center versus the actual treatment and reimbursement, being the focus.
Oh, that's really interesting, Dave. So help us understand, how are associations responding to this new or evolving trend?
Well, I think, a lot of scientific and healthcare meetings that we've seen, are really taking a good hard look at their future and trying to decide, can we be relevant moving forward. And, so often, science is published in so many journals, and, you wait 30 days and you're going to get the latest and greatest peer-reviewed stuff, versus, what do we get at meetings? And this is really, I think what a lot of healthcare associations are seeing, as well as they're seeing some adjustments in, their exhibit and sponsorship. I think we're seeing a lot of cutbacks on investments and exhibit footprints, because I think healthcare exhibitors are, trying to decide if that's the most effective way for them to, get noticed and to, hopefully increase their exposure or be more prescribed. And so in most industries, that's okay, because sponsorship is such a great outlet, and it's becoming more of a revenue stream that many of our customers are growing, but not so much in healthcare because of all the rules and regs What we end up getting is lesser effective investments in advertising and the like. So the revenue business models are getting somewhat disrupted in many healthcare conferences, and that's also playing out in another way where, you know, a lot of pharma and medical device companies used to pay pretty significant, mostly non-member rates to bring international contingencies to some of the larger healthcare conferences. What we've seen through analyzing numerous years is those numbers have gone way down, and those revenues have, which were once significant, are now much less for almost every major healthcare conference. So there's a lot of disruption that's taking place in those conferences and their business models.
Wow, there's a lot packed into that, Dave. I can't wait for to dig in deeper to learn more from you. Let's just go back to the whole peer review comment, right? I read an article that you wrote that you believe that peer review for conference abstracts is inefficient and it stifles innovation. Why do you think that?
Well, there's a couple things, and actually I just wrote another article on this very recently that you may not have seen yet, but you know, peer review is very much an inefficient but a very accepted form of publishing. What we see with most medical conferences is, you know, their attendance, some of them are, you know, having as much as 50, 60, we've even seen 80% of the attendance are actually on the program. So we call those meetings speakers speaking to speakers. And what happens is, you know, a lot of those conferences will accept abstract submissions. And, you know, usually what they'll do is they'll put a certain portion, maybe 10% of them or something, might become what's called oral abstracts. And those are basically then sessions where there's one abstract after another in rapid fire with very little collaboration. And then you'll get the balance of them. Almost all of them are accepted, but they're accepted and put on as poster presentations. And so the quality filters are very low. Usually for most medical or healthcare conferences, they're accepting every single submission or in the 95 plus percent range is most of what we see. But everybody's paying that full rate. And then when you really start peeling back the layers of the onion, you look at who's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, then we start seeing, you know, some of the business model challenges. And what a lot of these conferences have become is really more academic scientific conferences. So, you know, they're primarily professors at universities and also students and residents. And so what you see very little of is the mid-career professional who's actually doing a lot of the work. And you're seeing a lot less private practice participation, because a lot of private practice across almost everything we see, whether it be, you know, hardware stores or dentist offices or family practices, those are all of them are, you know, doing a roll up more to the corporate area. And in healthcare, that means, you know, more family practice, you know, more people that had their own practice are becoming part of systems or part of, larger groups that service, because they can't afford to do a lot of the little things that are required to keep up with regulation and insurance and malpractice and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot out there that's happening. And, you know, I think, you know, the big question is going to be, you know, should healthcare conferences, how much should they focus on scientific and advancing those needs versus how much should they focus on patient-centered or also practice improvement areas, which may not be CE qualified.
Okay. That's very interesting, Dave, because as you talk about kind of like the balance, scientific versus patient-centered versus the practice aspect of it, I'm thinking about technology and the empowered patient, right? How is technology impacting this evolution?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, you've got telemedicine and you've got, you know, the ability to monitor your own things. And I think a lot of those are very, very, you know, new, and we haven't seen the full impact that I think we're going to see on how that evolves, you know, care and how it, and the impact. I think it's, you know, the impact on meetings and healthcare associations is going to be more lagging. Right. And no question, you can't fight it. You need to find ways to enable it and to, you know, learn from it and to help your members, you know, learn from it, because it is the future. But, you know, the patient empowerment is a really big deal. I know in the health insurance space in particular, they want patients to take more control of their own health, and we're seeing that a lot of money being put into healthcare that you know on the tech side. There's actually whole conferences that are being born on investor related investments in healthcare technology, startups and the like, and so there's a lot. It's like the Wild West right now. So I think there's going to be a lot of changes coming forward.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like there's no one right answer or approach. There'll be many approaches that are tried before we can start to identify some effective practices. And with that said, Dave, what are your thoughts about the future of learning? With all of these trends and all of these issues out, and are you optimistic?
I think, you know, I think for the most part, you know, especially in the healthcare field, you know, individuals that got into that field did so because they wanted a passion of, you know, being able to heal or make a difference, you know, and with that, you know, came a very strong commitment to learning. And so, you know, what's I think awesome about healthcare is that, you know, it takes a lot. It takes special people, you know, to be in that profession, and right. they need to go through years and years of learning that you know, really, I think, you know, helps set them up as lifelong learners better than some of the other professions that we see. You know, so I think that's good. One of the things we did a lot of research recently on peer review, and get back to that topic for a second. And it was really interesting I found this one. I'm looking at an article. There's a gentleman by the name of Michael Jubb who did a research article called Peer Review, the Current Landscape and Future Trends. And he basically put out this big idea that there's growing opportunities for researchers to publish non-peer-reviewed articles for review in an open environment. And that really struck us when we were doing some research on the efficiency or inefficiency and future of peer review. And what we kind of realized is that you've got many scientific journals will cover details on research that has been completed, and completed is the key term. But most conference abstracts ideally should cover work that's in progress. So I think what the future is for healthcare is to look at your meetings for, you know, especially from the scientific angle, for work that's in progress, and how can we make that work that's in progress better in that open environment? How can we be that open environment? How can our meetings be that opening environment? Because if you go to healthcare conferences and you sit in these rooms where these abstracts are being delivered, you kind of want to shoot yourself. I mean, literally, they're, you know, 13 minutes, and maybe you get, you know, 60 to seconds of Q&A at the end, and then here comes another one. and they go bam, 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 like that 5 or 6 in an hour and a half. And it's like, wow. And you're out of, you know, you're just, it's just, you get peppered with stuff. And you know, the researchers can't wait to get their research out. They're proud of their work. But if they went in with the perspective of this needs improvement, my work's in progress, it needs improvement, I need to just tell people enough and tell them what I'm curious about, and ask them what they're, you know, how can I improve upon this? So it would be great if we could try to get, you know, less about getting the research out and more about how can we, you know, improve the research that's in process.
Right. So that's a very interesting point. So creating more of a learning community around the research. That's
it's kind of interesting. You know, I think there's a terminology called evidence-based education, and and evidence-based medicine is, you know, what everybody believes in, and evidence-based dentistry, and but, you know, when we think about education and how the adult brain learns, you know, there's been so much work that's been done and ahas that have been done over the past 15 years, but you know, many scientific meetings haven't changed. So they don't, you know, it's kind of hypocritical that a scientific meeting or a healthcare meeting would actually have lectures, even they use that term, lecture or panel, is very contradictory of what the evidence says about how the adult brain learns. And, you know, I think there's a lot of medical schools and that are changing and getting less out of the lecture format. And they know that the best way to learn is when you're, you know, a resident, you're going through the rounds and actually, you know, seeing and doing the work and being able to, you know, be more hands-on and things like that. It's not through somebody talking to you or watching a video. So I think what, you know, most scientific or healthcare meetings should do is really, you know, to kind of take an oath to embrace evidence-based education and try to, you know, really look for, you know, faculty or presenters that can be more facilitators of learning versus the expert at the front.
Well, that's a very interesting point. How do you see this connecting or influencing the younger generation engagement in these meetings? And do you see them responding well to it? Or do you have any stories you'd like to share based on organizations you've worked with?
Yeah, I think, you know, many, you know, I think there's a shortage of doctors, there's a shortage of medical professions, and many, you know, that I've heard that from a number of our clients, that the pipeline is needs to grow, and the pipeline is getting much more diverse. We do know that as well, which I think is important. You're going to see, you know, these healthcare conferences, when you see the student population are much heavier female, and they're much more diverse, which you know, that the profession definitely needs. So, but I think students, you know, a lot of associations kind of take the attitude with students of, let's get them while they're young, you know, and so they, you know, will give them free membership, they'll give, or next to nothing, they'll charge them very low prices to come to the meeting. You know, you hear a lot of, you know, program committees say, hey, let's put the kids in the show, and let's, you know, give them a chance. Let's give the kid a chance. They're given some presentation opportunities. And what happens, though, with that is we've seen a number of conferences that actually aren't attracting as many mid-career professionals, because you go to the conference and you look at it and it looks like a student conference. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every association needs a good, you know, emerging professional or student strategy. The question is how does that play out at your most visible premium conference that you do? And what portion of that should be there? You know, we've done a number of analysis of students, or you know, and what we always look for is, you know, what is the conversion? And you kind of got to look at it over years of time. And what we find is, you know, if they're early in their college degree career and attending, they're very unlikely to convert or to be able to be tracked back to a conversion. If they're more like a resident or a grad student, so they've taken the second or third commitment towards that career, they're much more likely to convert. So, you know, students, all students are not created equal. It's a really tough decision to try to decide, you know, how to invest in students. But, you know, I think a lot of our customers that we work with, we're working with them hard to try to, you know, to readdress their student policy for what makes sense for them, and how does it apply to their annual conference versus what else are they doing all year round. And so there's no right or wrong answer, but, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, most of the time you're making a big investment to have students there because mm-hmm. they're priced below. And the question is that the best way to spend your membership's money? And how much of it should you be spending in that area? Those are, you know, I think questions that more and more organizations are going to look at. But what we see is we're seeing more organizations looking at developing more robust emerging professional programs and go a little lighter on the student side of things. So they're putting their money more into those early career versus versus the student.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Dave. Let's shift gears for a moment and let's talk about the trade show floor. You mentioned that there's been a cutback on the exhibit floor because it's, you know, not an effective way to get noticed. So what are the new trends?
You know, I think about a couple of projects we did last year in the healthcare space, and I'm not going to mention names, but, you know, we heard one healthcare conference that's very elite and successful. You know, Eli Lilly was a significant exhibitor, and they cut back to a 10x10, and they did that for every show. They just made the decision, and now this is a big company, right? You know, and Eli Lilly, they're not saying we won't, you know, we're not going to give you a $250,000 grant. They're saying that expo floor, we're 10x10. That's it. And they'll still send, you know, they may still send, you know, 20 or 30 people to participate in the conference, but, you know, not on the expo floor. So they've made a decision. And the other thing we see is we, you know, I think a lot of the attendees don't have the buying influence or the influence to, you know, potentially get, you know, a device company or a pharma company selected as the choice. And so, you know, I think they're not walking the floors. And so a lot of them are pretty, you know, you can shoot a cannon off on in some of the exhibit halls. We had one large, not large, I would say mid-size healthcare conference that, you know, kind of decided to do away with their expo altogether, which was a really bold move. So what they are doing is they're basically creating this, you know, this kind of hubs area, and the hub area is going to be, you know, potentially by, you know, organized by disease site, which a lot of associations are starting to do, is to organize by disease site, or to have some sort of organization within the exhibit hall. So there's more, you know, some people call it neighborhooding. And so these exhibit halls are becoming less traditional, and they're becoming more learning hubs around disease sites. So you might have, you know, a certain neighborhood might be around, you know, colon cancer, for example, and, you know, the posters that are around that are displayed in that area are around colon cancer. And then, you know, potentially any exhibitors that might be in that area or anchor exhibitors maybe more have, you know, either procedures or devices or, you know, treatments that, that, you know, more often than not will help that. So we're seeing some neighborhooding, and we're seeing some kind of flips in a lot of rebranding too. Is like, you know, the term expo or exhibit hall is kind of going away, and a lot of these progressive organizations are trying to, you know, turn these exhibit halls more into a learning destination, and they may be rebranding them as a, like a discovery zone or a discovery hub or solution center or something like that. So they're evolving. Another thing that we've seen, you know, to kind of, you know, make them more of a learning destination is we're seeing, you know, some organizations are trying to figure out how do they do posters better. And so you're seeing some are, you know, doing posters electronically in e-posters, but we're also seeing things called like poster huddles, where, you know, the poster is the centerpiece, and, you know, potentially these are maybe the top 10% of the posters that were graded, and those are being presented and discussed orally in more of a, you know, open theater environment. So we're seeing some of that as well. But just generally the evolution of these trade show floors are going towards a learning experience.
Well, you've provided quite a few examples, concrete examples of how our members, particularly here, you know, in Chicago, healthcare associations can enhance their shows. Really great examples. Thank you for that. But, you know, in which leads me into this whole, you know, you're talking about experiences essentially, right? And so let's talk about the smaller association. How do they, that does not necessarily have a level of investment, right? Cannot make the investment that most organizations, how do they compete? How do they become effective?
Well, I think, you know, things are becoming more subspecialty focused. You know, it's funny, we've done a lot of work over the years with Canadian Medical Association, and I'll never forget, you know, one of the things they mentioned to us during one of the engagements was, you know, it used to be that, you know, I think it was like 10 years ago or 12 years ago, there was like 40 or 50 subspecialties associations in Canada. Now it's and then it was like almost 90. So the amount of, you know, specialization, I think people are always looking for relevance. So, you know, I think the smaller, more niche associations is kind of what people are looking for in a lot of things, because some of these larger medical conferences, they're too complex. You know, they're, it's too much of a hassle because I got to get on a bus. A lot of times people want the smaller conferences. They want to go to, you know, be with, you know, 200 peers in Vail on a ski weekend versus going to, you know, San Francisco and needing to bus in and to, you know, fight for a seat and all that, and try to figure out which of these 30 sessions should I go to at that time slot. So I think small is you know, currently at an advantage to take share away from the larger ones. So what I think if you're a larger one, you're trying to improve relevance and to try to find a way to, you know, service those niche groups and those subspecialties in a new way, which is easier said than done. You know, I think the smaller is people are looking for those, you know, more intimate experiences and higher relevance.
Can we say small is the new big?
Yeah, well, it's, I think relevance is winning the day is the bigger thing. So, you know, finding ways to deliver on relevance is good. And you see a lot of associations, a lot of larger associations are, you know, that's why you do the neighborhooding in the exhibit hall, right? You're trying to make something much more complex, you know, more user-friendly, easier to find, et cetera. So I think if you're a healthcare association and you know you've got this, you know, your conference has always been everything to everybody, you know, that's where you know, those are the ones that I think are going to get hurt the most. And finding ways to be more relevant is going to be important. But also part of that is being better curators, right? So, you know, you can't necessarily just take everything submitted, and you can't keep, you know, going down this abstract model where you your meeting grows if you have more speaker slots. You know, raising the bar on quality and being better curators is going to be, I think, something that you want to do for at least a portion of your program.
Great. Well, Dave, thank you so much for being generous with your time. So as we conclude the podcast today, I'd just like to give you an opportunity to share some final thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, I think the big rallying cry that we tend to have with a lot of healthcare associations when we really do an audience analysis. And when you do an audience analysis, you have to kind of, you know, really get it down, like remove the students, remove, you know, just really try to focus on who's paying to be there that's possibly not speaking. And, you know, so what is the justification? Really understand who they are and trying to figure out how to grow those segments. So I think, you know, thinking more targeted, which, you know, in this world of high inclusion, is kind of it's not necessarily a popular way to think, but the more you can grow the mid-career practitioner, we do believe that that's going to, you know, lead to growth. Because if you think about it, if you're trying to, you know, get that sustainability and get that early career professional, they're going to do what their mentor or who they're learning from does. And if that, and that's usually a mid-career professional. So if that mid-career professional, if you have their attention and loyalty, you're more than likely going to get that passed off to the next generation coming up behind them. So we really believe mid-career is kind of that, almost that forgotten segment that so much of us need to really try to figure out how to win back that, and we do believe that that'll yield to more long-term sustainability.
I promise, this is the last question, Dave. How do you define mid-career?
It differs by organization. A lot of times we've been in the 6 to 15 year range because, you know, like healthcare, for example, you know, you're going to 6-8 years of college. And then you're doing your residency. So, you know, 6 years into the practice is pretty significant. Somewhere along those lines. So we look at a lot of, you know, demographics as far as age or career, years in career, and we really recommend that you focus more on years of career than age for, you know, sustainability and trying to make sure that you're measuring that. But 1 to 5 would be more early career, and then 6 to 15-ish is mid.
Okay, well, wonderful. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conversation with Dave Lutz, Managing Director of Velvet Chainsaw Consulting. We thank Dave for his generosity of time, knowledge, and expertise to share with us the latest trends and opportunities as it relates to healthcare and medical meetings. Dave, we appreciate you and thank our guests for listening. Until next time.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.